A much better deal today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. President Trump says he's canceling the Obama administration's deal with Cuba and has harsh words for the Castros and their legacy.
We will never, ever be blind to it. We know what's going on and we remember what happened.
This Cuban American likes the president's message to Cuba.
That olive branch is still there, but now you have to do the specific things to deserve that olive branch.
But some argue Trump's making a mistake.
The United States don't promote human rights in Cuba by limiting the right of Americans to travel to the island.
Cuban relations refrozen today on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. It's almost like President Trump wanted to distract the nation's attention from his own big announcement today. Before getting on a plane to Florida, where he unveiled a new Cuba policy, Trump once again tweeted his frustration at the Russia investigation. The president called it a witch hunt and lashed out at those involved. He also threw Washington for a loop by appearing to confirm that he himself is under investigation. Then Trump's personal lawyer denied that's what he meant. So yeah, that pointed the spotlight away from Miami for much of the day. And of course, we'll keep following that Russia investigation wherever it points. But we begin the show today with Trump's Cuba announcement in Miami, and it was a big one.
Effective immediately, I am canceling the last administration's completely one-sided deal with Cuba.
Speaking before a largely Cuban-American audience in Miami's Little Havana neighborhood, the president also had a tough message for Cuba's communist leaders.
To the Cuban government, I say, put an end to the abuse of dissidents. Release the political prisoners. Stop jailing innocent people. Open yourselves to political and economic freedoms.
That was President Trump in Miami this afternoon. The World's Maria Muriel reports on U.S.-Cuba relations. Maria, what has President Trump changed?
Hey, Carol. The biggest thing that President Trump changed today is definitely that American businesses are no longer allowed to do any business transactions with something called GAESA, which is the Cuban military's sort of enterprise administrative branch, if you will. They control it's the part of the Cuban government that controls their business ventures. And if you go to Cuba, likely most businesses that you patronize are going to be government run. So that's a pretty big change in the policy today. Another thing is Americans can still travel to Cuba, especially Cuban Americans, but there's still no tourism allowed. You can't just go on a Cuban vacation to Havana or Varadero. And also they're making changes to the people-to-people exchanges that the Obama administration had made a provision for. Now, if you want to go to Cuba, you have to go through a group, a sort of sanctioned group tour for learning about the culture.
What's the goal of this policy change?
President Trump said the goal is to pressure the communist regime in Cuba to act on behalf of human rights. There are still political prisoners in Cuba. The Castro regime still controls the islands. It does not allow the private sector to flourish. And this is something that President Trump says will probably be aided by this change in policy.
Are these changes really that significant, or are they enough for Trump to say he did something to repeal the Obama changes?
Well, you know, on paper, it really doesn't seem that way. You know, Obama established 12 categories under which Americans could travel to Cuba. Those are still going to be in place, and the embassies are still going to be open. So really, these tweaks don't seem that significant. But it will be harder for Americans to travel to Cuba. And avoiding business transactions with a government entity once you're on the island is really difficult.
So who's going to be pleased with this announcement today?
Trump had a lot of support from the Cuban exile community in Miami during the election. About 54% of Cubans in Miami voted for Trump. So this is probably going to be pleasing for those people. During the speech today, he had a lot of people there, you know, chanting Cuba sí, Castro no, which is a slogan that Cuban Americans use when talking about the Castro regime. And so this policy was really crafted for them, it seems. And it was also crafted by Trump with the help of Marco Rubio, Senator Marco Rubio, and Mario Diaz-Balart, who are Cuban American politicians. They are conservative on the issue of Cuban relations with the U.S., and they're part of a faction of Cuban Americans that are the hardliners. They really believe that we should not engage with the Cuban government unless they make human rights concessions. And they were critical. This same faction was always critical of Obama's push to open up relations with Cuba. So those are the kinds of people that are going to be pleased with this Trump rollback, even if it doesn't seem that significant. You know, we'll probably hear from people who are saying this is a step in the right direction.
And of course, the U.S. embargo against Cuba is still in effect, as it has been since, I think, 1961.
Right. We still don't openly trade with Cuba.
The World's Maria Muriel. Great to speak with you.
Thanks, Carol.
I think this is an important first step to try to roll back some of the failed policies that the Obama administration put out towards Cuba.
Ariana Mendez is a young Cuban-American living in Miami. And as you just heard there, she supports Trump's plan to roll back on the opening to Cuba.
I think opening relationships with the United States or having talks with the United States, it's a reward for good behavior, for a good human rights record, for a good record on economics. And I think that the Castro regime has done nothing to merit that outreach. And I think that President Trump has the right idea of trying to restrict travel to Cuba and try to restrict the commercial relationship with Cuba that is only benefiting the Castro government.
Now, Trump's policy doesn't entirely reverse Obama's rapprochement with Havana. In your opinion, do Trump's policies go far enough?
I think that it's impossible to say that Trump can single-handedly, with one announcement, undo everything that Obama did. I think this is a good first step. And I think it's important to point out that this is changing the tone. When the Obama administration came out with the changes in policy, this was supposed to extend an olive branch to the Cuban people. This is saying that olive branch is still there, but now you have to do the specific things to deserve that olive branch. And if not, we'll take it away because you don't deserve to have it in the first place. If you're not willing to protect your own people and actually implement policies that benefit not just the higher up in the top ranking members of the Communist Party, but the poor Cuban on the street. And I think that's a very important change of pace.
Now, you said that Trump's change in policy is a good first step. What do you want Trump's next step to be?
I actually want a very hardline stance. I want clear benchmarks, and if those benchmarks are not met, there will be consequences, either in the form of business, in the form of aid. I think that we're getting to a point in time in history that a Castro regime needs to realize that it's a relic of a failed philosophy, and it cannot continue to punish the Cuban people in that way.
Ariana, can you tell us a little bit about your family history? What's their opinion of the Castro regime?
Well, personally, I was born in the United States. My parents came here in the late 80s. My mother is in her 50s. My father is in his late 60s. And they went through a very interesting situation through Cuba. Their family businesses were nationalized. Their homes were nationalized. And they were blacklisted and were not able to leave the country for many years because of their prior affiliation to Batista. So they eventually made their way to sunny California. And that's where I was born, and we later moved down here to Miami.
Ariana, do you have any kids of your own?
No, I don't. Not yet.
If you eventually do have kids, what kind of relationship would you like your children to have with Cuba?
You know, it's a very strange feeling, but unlike Irish Americans, Mexican Americans, I don't really have a place that I can trace my ancestry to. My parents came from Cuba, but the stories they share with me of the Cuba that they lived in, that Cuba is lost forever. So the relationship I want my children to have with Cuba is one of remembering the Cuba that my parents talked to me about, enjoying the food, enjoying the culture of my parents' generation. But essentially, I have no place to tell them, please go back there and look at your grandparents' hometown. Please go back and look at the beauties of the city. There's nothing left of what my parents left behind.
Ariana Mendez in Miami. She supports President Trump's Cuba policy. Thanks, Ariana.
Thank you.
That's one view of President Trump's announcement today, rolling back on the opening to Cuba that his predecessor had set in motion. Not surprisingly, there are also those who don't agree with Trump's move.
It's a mistake.
Arturo Lopez Levy worked for the Cuban government in the 1990s. He resigned and left the island. He now teaches at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley. I asked Arturo what he's most opposed to in Trump's policy.
The most important objection would be to the issue of travel, because it might reduce the number of Americans traveling to Cuba, and it will give the wrong example. The United States don't promote human rights in Cuba by limiting the right of Americans to travel to the island.
Who do you think Trump's policies will hurt the most?
Well, it will hurt the most the possibilities of political opening and economic reform in Cuba. And the people that are receiving these benefits that are tangible and intangible are the Cuban population at large.
But it's not as if Cuba has changed a whole lot since Obama's reaching out to them a couple of years ago. I mean, human rights situation, political freedom, none of that has really improved a whole lot.
Well, I will disagree with that. I think that one important thing is to keep a policy long enough to harvest good results. In the case of Cuba, for more than 56 years, there was a policy of hostility and isolation, and every time this hostility and isolation increases, human rights situation deteriorate. In the case of the last 2 years of Obama's policy, there was a significant reduction in the number of long-term detention. The right to travel of the Cuban was expanded, and also the right to own private property had a major expansion. So I agree that America should express solidarity with victims of repressions, but even in this, in the case of that, the situation improved.
Now, as part of his plan, Trump wants to prohibit financial transactions with companies that are controlled by the military. Isn't this a good first step to ensure that it's the Cuban people, not the military, who reap the benefits of American engagement?
No, because whoever underestimate the importance of nationalism in Cuban culture has proven to be always wrong. Targeting the military will only rally the people around the flag and make more difficult important transition in civil-military relations that are approaching in Cuban history with the retirement of Raúl Castro and the rise to the presidency of the first civilian.
Now, there are some people out there who say that Trump's changes are really cosmetic, that they're just kind of a sop to a conservative constituency in southern Florida, and it's more rhetoric than real action. How do you respond to that?
I think that language matters, and in this case, it will make the environment and the air between the two countries nasty, and that's not the way to proceed.
What do you suggest the next step in Cuba policy be?
I think that it should be end the embargo. It's true that it will strengthen temporarily the Cuban communist government, but it will unleash dynamics of reforms that might in the future lead to a more democratic and friendly toward the United States Cuba.
Arturo Lopez Levy teaches at the University of Texas. He's co-author of Raúl Castro and the New Cuba. Thanks, Arturo.
It's a great pleasure.
We'll have more Cuba coverage later in the show, including a deeper look at Cuba's military and how much economic power it wields.
Some people compare it to an octopus. It's got tentacles everywhere.
And we'll also have the story of an Iraqi living in the U.S. who thinks he shouldn't be deported.
I just think as long as I'm focused on the American dream and opening up business and hiring people and paying my taxes, I should be allowed to stay here.
That's all coming up. And just ahead, a dreamer gets a break. You're with the world. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with the world. President Trump is letting the so-called dreamers stay. for now. This is a reversal for the president. As a candidate, Trump had vowed to end a program that shielded undocumented immigrants who came to the U.S. as small children from deportation. But now the administration says the program, known as Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, will continue, at least in the short term. Erica Jasmine is originally from Mexico and now lives in Minnesota. She's one of the hundreds of thousands of DACA recipients who are now breathing a sigh of relief. Erica, what does DACA getting renewed mean for your life, just on a practical level?
It means a lot. A lot of people do not understand how that relief really helped us. It took a lot of people out of the shadows. It gave us a light at the end of the tunnel. So, yes, it is life-changing for me.
So practically, though, you can stay on indefinitely. Do you register every 2 years? Is that how it works?
Yes, we renew our permits every 2 years. You have to be consistent with it, which means you have to have no criminal record. You have to keep working or studying, whichever applies to each person. And you have to be a good citizen. And it's just not a free ticket, you know.
White House officials have said that President Trump has not yet decided on the long-term fate of the DACA program. So where does that leave you, really?
It leaves me in the limbo. But at least it's a limbo that I have hope to come out of. I know that we don't have a path to citizenship right now, or at least to a permanent residency. And a lot of people do not understand that I see a lot of comments on the media, on Facebook, Twitter. Why don't you just apply for citizenship? It's not that easy. There is no path. I mean, even myself and a lot of people around me, a lot of people that are released under this program, we are willing to do anything possible, but we just don't have that option. There is no option out there.
So even though DACA's continued, what continues is the ability to stay on and every 2 years register, but there's no guarantee or path to a permanent residency or citizenship.
No, not at all. We don't have access to any benefits. We don't have access to anything. We only have an option to work, get a driver's license, and have the relief of not being deported. That's it.
Can you tell us a little bit about your story? How did your family come to the U.S. and why did they choose to make the journey?
I learned this when I was older. Obviously, when I came here, I didn't even know I was undocumented until I got older. My father got laid off at work in Mexico. He looked and looked for many years, and we were about to lose our house. We didn't have anything, no food, nothing. So they decided to move and cross the border and make something out of ourselves. And we did it. I am an accountant. My brother is in engineering. And we're working really hard. We try to make the best out of it, even with no legal documentation.
So you and your brother are both DACA recipients?
Yes, we are. We want to be Americans.
Erica Jasmine is originally from Mexico. She now lives in Minnesota, and she's one of the hundreds of thousands of DACA recipients who got some good news today. Thanks, Erica.
Thank you.
Victims of domestic violence face a lot of hurdles getting out of violent relationships. That's why several U.S. states have laws that at least protect the jobs of domestic abuse victims. They require employers to give victims time off with pay to deal with the fallout and also guarantee job security. That's starting to happen in Canada as well. The province of Manitoba has already passed such a law, and Ontario is considering one too. Anita Elash has more on what's happening north of the border.
Christine was in her early 20s when her husband started hitting her.
He became physical with me to the point where he had put me up against the fridge and tried to rip the gum out of my throat and almost had his entire hand in my mouth.
She knew she had to leave, but she just started working and she couldn't find the courage to ask for time off.
I thought, what are they going to think, you know? Is there going to be problems with her in the workplace? You know, she's new. Is she going to be missing lots of time? I was scared. I was very scared. Because especially at that point, then I couldn't afford to lose my job.
And that's a big concern. A recent survey in Canada found that nearly 1 in 10 workers experiencing domestic abuse lost their job because of it. Part-time and hourly workers are especially vulnerable. Barb McQuarrie is the researcher who did that survey. She says abuse victims often struggle at work, but they're too embarrassed to tell anyone about it. and that can make things worse.
Employers who aren't prepared to be supportive or don't understand what's going on might just put all of that back onto the woman and say, this is too much trouble to have you in the workplace. You're fired.
Christine's boss supported her when she left her husband, and she kept her job. But she's still so ashamed about what happened to her that she's asked me not to use her real name. Michelle Gavronsky also spent years in an abusive marriage.
Our biggest fight was always about money, and there was never enough money. And so if I was to say to my husband, I can't pay the bill, I can't pay Hydro this week because we don't have enough money, he would get very angry and then the violence would start.
One night after an especially bad fight, she packed up her four children and drove to her mother's house in Winnipeg.
I thought my kids should not be going through this, especially my daughters. So I left.
It was familiar territory for Michelle. Her mom had been abused too by Michelle's father. In the end, both women escaped the violence, but Michelle's road was a lot easier. That's because she got a week off with pay to move out and go to court. Her mother was fired for missing work and ended up on welfare for 18 months.
She didn't have a job now to pay for a lawyer. She didn't have a job to be able to leave the shelter to feed her children. She didn't have a place to live. She didn't have a protection order because she was unable to get the lawyer to get a restraining order. It was just compounded huge.
Michelle's now the head of a major labor union, and she advocates for legislation that would give workers paid time off to deal with domestic violence. Some employers in Canada say that abuse victims could use vacation or sick days, and that mandated time isn't necessary. But not every worker gets that option. Michelle Gavronsky says that at the end of the day, her employer benefited from the paid leave just as much as she did.
I was able to concentrate on my job better. I knew I wasn't late for work because my husband was abusing me anymore. I wasn't showing up for work trying to hide bruises. My whole demeanor was different. I was more confident. I was happier in the workplace. And people would say, you're back to your old self. Like, we're glad to see this.
For The World, Anita Elash, Toronto.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills. Some Iraqis living in the U.S. are being deported. This man could be on the next plane out, and he's scared to go back to Iraq.
From my understanding, they would just drop you off in Baghdad, and that's the biggest fear in the world. Because I wouldn't even know what to do after that, and we have no family, we have nothing there. Absolutely nothing.
His story, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. With God's help, a free Cuba is what we will soon achieve. That's a line from President Trump's speech today in Miami, where he announced that he's hitting pause on President Obama's celebrated opening to Cuba. Trump's new policy will focus on restricting travel to Cuba by Americans, but more importantly, perhaps, it aims to prevent U.S. businesses from dealing with companies owned by the Cuban armed forces.
We will very strongly restrict American dollars flowing to the military, security, and intelligence services that are the core of the Castro regime. They will be restricted.
Paul Hare is a former British ambassador to Cuba. He now teaches international relations at Boston University. Paul, Donald Trump wants to stop money going to the Cuban military. It seems like a reasonable thing to do on the face of it, but just how widespread is the Cuban military's economic reach on the island?
Well, in terms of their presence in the hard currency earning sector, so things like tourism, the ports, logistics, and communications, it's the monopoly. They've been very careful in allowing the military to play prominent roles in key strategic sectors, so that they can control the inflow of hard currency, and obviously the government then has access to it. So probably about 70%, most people think, that there are no accounts published, so it's very difficult to know. 70% of all the hard currency that Cuba earns externally will be generated by military-run companies.
I hear this acronym GAESA, G-A-E-S-A. What does GAESA literally mean?
It means, it's a very boring name, actually. It means basically an administrative group for enterprises. And it's been built up over really the last 25 years or so to, some people compare it to an octopus. It's got tentacles everywhere. And it gradually swallows up more areas of activity. If you want to get a SIM card for your phone, I mean, the company that issues those, there's only one, you know, will be military run.
What does the Cuban military do with the money that it gets from all these businesses it runs? Do they buy tanks, or is it something more subtle than that?
It's really the hard currency coffers of the government. So anything they need to do to provide for health services, for education, security services, yes, but most of that is not, you know, tanks any longer or MiG fighters. Most people think their military is pretty out of date and poorly maintained. But in terms of state security, the policing, you know, monitoring of people's activities, all that sort of stuff, this is where they get their money from.
Who controls the money? I mean, is there much corruption that we know of?
There is corruption, and the military, I'm sure, are guilty of some of that themselves. But they've been pretty strong on rooting out corruption. They've been high-level officials. There was one recently who was in charge of the aviation sector who was fired for corruption. Others in charge of food importing have been also fired for corruption. Raul, I mean, the Castros live very well, so they're not too concerned about obviously taking bribes or things like that, because they live very well without that. But corruption will increasingly be a problem. These companies have enormous sway over dealing with big foreign investor companies. They're handling big amounts of money, big loans.
So essentially, the Cuban military is the recipient of the hard currency that comes in. I mean, the large amounts of hard currency that come into the country, and then can decide how it's going to use that hard currency.
Well, the Cuban military is essentially the government. Raul Castro, you know, was the Minister of Defense for 50 years until he became president. And the key members of the Communist Party, which rule the country, the Politburo, the Council of State, many of them have dual status in the Communist Party and the military. So they are the military. There's no separation. It's a seamless organization, a seamless link between the Cuban government and the military.
Paul Hare is a lecturer at Boston University. He's also a former British ambassador to Cuba. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
President Trump's big announcement on Cuba overshadowed another event in Miami today, a meeting of Central American and U.S. leaders. Tim Padgett is the Americas editor at Station WLRN in Miami. I asked him what the Conference on Prosperity and Security in Central America is all about.
It's very interesting because it involves both Central American heads of state, particularly from the Northern Triangle of Central America, Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, where the worst crises are evident, but also the highest levels of the Trump administration, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly, and Vice President Mike Pence, who spoke here yesterday at the conference. It's very unusual to see that kind of U.S. government cachet assembled to meet with Central American heads of state. And so it was a very good opportunity for Central America to sort of present itself in a U.S. spotlight to get the help it needs for the very frightening problems it's got down there in terms of poverty, corruption, but mostly gang violence, which is what forces so many of the undocumented immigrants that we've been seeing in the past few years over our border.
So is the point of this kind of summit to address these problems? What are we going to do about them?
Well, Vice President Pence yesterday at the conference made the point President Trump knows that these problems have to be confronted at their source, and not just at the border. And that's an approach that President Obama started taking. You'll remember a few years ago when we saw all those awful images of unaccompanied children from Honduras pouring over the U.S. border, escaping largely gang violence. The Northern Triangle of Central America is widely considered the deadliest zone in the world outside of Syria. And that's the big reason we've got such an illegal immigration crisis coming out of that region.
What do the Central American leaders want the U.S. to do?
They want the U.S. to keep on this path that was started back a few years ago during that time that President Obama started, a program known as the Alliance for Prosperity. He proposed a $1 billion project, which would bring a lot more U.S. social aid to Central America in terms of job opportunities, in terms of police and judicial and government reform. So what they're hoping is that President Trump will pick up that baton and continue that approach. The problem, though, is that his budget is showing a more than 30% cut in aid for Central America. So I think the cabinet members who came here this week were trying to assure everybody that, no, we're still committed to helping Central America recover. Because Central America is really a major source of two issues that greatly affect and greatly divide this country, drugs and illegal immigration. The biggest problem is the drug violence in Central America that, as I said before, is pushing so many, particularly young people, whom the gangs want to recruit. And if they refuse to be recruited, they're simply murdered.
Are the Central American leaders putting any pressure on the Trump administration to be more lenient with child and teen migrants who are coming over the border? Is there any negotiation going on there?
Yes, I spoke with the Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez just before the conference started, and he said that was one of his concerns, that we may see under the Trump administration more of a mass deportation of undocumented Honduran migrants, particularly the young people. And he thinks that that would be simply counterproductive to the effort to solve the very problems in Honduras that the U.S. says it's trying to solve with programs like the Alliance for Prosperity. So, yes, I think they are pushing back on that.
Are these countries really dependent on the U.S. to try to solve this? I mean, do they have any other countries they can go to for aid?
Realistically, no. You might think Mexico would be a good partner for them, and it does try to fill that role to a certain extent. But the U.S. really is the only country that has the resources and the diplomatic and political leverage in this hemisphere to get some of these things done. It really is up to the U.S. to sort of take the international community leadership on this problem of Central America.
Is Miami consumed with Trump and Cuba, or are they focusing much on this other Central American conference?
Well, they would have been more focused on the Central America conference had it not been for Trump swooping in this week to make his announcement on Cuba policy. This is Miami, after all. Cuba is the most important foreign policy issue here, despite the fact that in terms of issues that directly affect the United States, Central America is more important. That's not to minimize, for example, the human rights problem in Cuba, but in terms of issues that really affect the United States, Central America is more important. And this was a chance, I think, for Americans to sort of appreciate that a little better. But as is often the case in Miami, Cuba steps up to the fore again.
Tim Padgett is the Americas editor at WLRN in Miami. Yesterday on the show, we heard the story of Raed Jabou. He's an Iraqi who, after living in Michigan for decades, was deported back to Iraq in April.
I was shackled. I was handcuffed all the way until I landed in Baghdad.
Jabou, who's Christian, now fears for his life. His deportation came after a deal was struck between the U.S. and Iraqi governments back in March. The U.S. agreed to take Iraq off its travel ban list. Iraq agreed to take in deportees from the U.S. Today we hear the story of another Iraqi man in the U.S. who's facing possible deportation. The real Shirin Jafari picks up the story from Michigan.
What happened to Raed Jabou and seven other Iraqis in April has created a frenzy among Iraqi Americans in Michigan. Michigan has the largest Iraqi community in the U.S. Many are Chaldeans. Chaldeans are Catholic Iraqis. They've left Iraq over the years because of religious persecution and war. Now some fear being sent back to the very country they fled. Iman Jojoni Damon is an immigration lawyer representing some of them.
People are absolutely losing it. You know, families are distraught. I'm getting calls nonstop that they just pick them up. Some they go to their work. Some they attack them at 4 a.m. in the morning from their homes and pluck them right out of bed from their families.
Many of the people facing deportation have lived here for years, decades. For Jojoni Damon, sending them back to a war zone goes against what the U.S. stands for.
We are violating the very essence and the basics of human rights by taking someone knowing they will die and sending them back there.
That car was hit in the front and the side, so we're replacing the entire bumper reinforcement.
One of Jojoni Damon's clients runs an auto body shop outside Detroit. He doesn't want to use his real name because he fears deportation, so we call him Bob. The day I visit, Bob is wearing a tight black t-shirt and dark jeans. He's bulky and has a buzz cut. Bob came to the U.S. in 1974 when he was a kid. He left Iraq with his mom.
I don't remember anything at all. I was 4 years old. I absolutely have no idea. I don't speak the language.
When Bob was a teenager, he hung out with the wrong crowd. He began selling drugs.
At 17 years old, I was charged with possession intent to deliver 3.5 grams of cocaine in a state case. That state case, I was found guilty and given probation.
But then he went on to sell more cocaine, which got him into trouble again. At 20 years old, he was sentenced to 17 years in prison. In prison, Bob decided to make something of himself.
I worked at the prison industry there. I saved up my money and paid for my own college through correspondence courses.
He got a BA in finance, and after serving 17 years, he was released in 2004. He started working, saving up to open his auto body shop. Today, he employs 13 people. His criminal record, though, makes him vulnerable to deportation. But since 2004, he's checked in with immigration regularly, and every time he's been allowed to stay since he's kept out of trouble. But then politics, world politics changed. The U.S. and Iraq struck a deal. Iraq would accept deportees from the U.S. In return, the U.S. would take Iraq off the travel ban list. Now, Bob's afraid he'll get deported. His criminal past doesn't make him look good, even though he served his time.
There's fear. There's definitely panic. From my understanding, they would just drop you off in Baghdad, and that's the biggest fear in the world. Because I wouldn't even know what to do after that, and we have no family. We have nothing there. Absolutely nothing.
Many Chaldeans here own small businesses. Historically, they've supported the Republican Party, thinking they're pro-business and uphold Christian values. Bob isn't a U.S. citizen, so he can't vote. But if he could, he would have voted for Trump.
He seems to be the first president to even care about Iraqi Christians, helping them, saving them.
What specifically did he say that made you think
that we need to protect Christians? Him, Vice President Pence. Our last president never said that. At least he's talking about it. And, you know, he's our advocate.
But he might be sending you back.
That's a different issue. I know. I'm caught up in the mix of that issue. I'm caught up in a policy.
So you wouldn't change your mind even if you're sent back to Iraq?
No, I would not change my mind. Absolutely. It doesn't change my belief.
Currently, 1,400 Iraqis have final court orders to leave. Iman Jojoni Damon, the lawyer we heard from earlier, says that if the goal of these deportations is to protect the U.S. from criminals, we're looking in the wrong place.
These people who have served their time, finished, done, came out, they report to ICE every so often. The government knows everything about them, where they work, what they do, where they live. So if there is one group of people that could pose zero threat to our community, is them.
Others, like Mark Krikorian of the Conservative Center for Immigration Studies, disagree.
It's long overdue. The fact is, these people should have been returned to Iraq when they committed their crimes or when they were released from prison.
Plus, he says,
I have just no sympathy for people complaining that they should be allowed to stay here even though they have committed serious felonies.
But for Bob, it feels like double punishment. He spent years in prison, lived in the U.S. for years after, and now he's facing deportation.
I just think as long as I'm focused on the American dream and opening up business and hiring people and paying my taxes, I should be allowed to stay here.
As we say goodbye, Bob points out that next time, he might be speaking with me from Baghdad. For The World, Shirin Jafari, Warren, Michigan.
I'm Carol Hills with The World. The city of Thessaloniki used to be a center of Jewish life in Greece. Just before the start of World War II, there were about 50,000 Jews living there. When the war ended, fewer than 2,000 remained. The ancient Jewish cemetery in Thessaloniki was also destroyed, its gravestones scattered. But a few in the city's small Jewish community are reclaiming the lost stones and memories. Renee Gross has a story.
Josef Viena has a hectic schedule, working 13-hour shifts at this pharmacy.
But when he gets a free moment, there's something he's been meaning to do. Return an ancient Jewish tombstone to a cemetery.
This is the tombstone.
Vienna opens a bathroom door and pushes aside some mops to reveal a large stone. It's about a foot tall and a foot wide, with faded Hebrew scripture on it. When Vienna found it loose in some steps, he picked it up in his hands.
I lifted it, put it in my car, and I brought it here, where I can stow it away for, in any case, it's a bit more dignified than having people step on it.
You can find fragments of headstones all over the city. They're embedded in churches, buildings, even sidewalks. But taking one of these stones is illegal because they're considered historical property.
Most of the time, simply record and photograph them because they're embedded in pavements, they're embedded in walls, they're embedded in stairs. I cannot tear off the cement. Only what I can move, not get arrested.
Vienna remembers the first time he saw one of these fragments. He was about 10 years old and didn't really understand what it was.
We played in the churchyard. Here there are Jewish letters. I don't know the tombstones, but I just know that they were Jewish letters.
Eventually, Vienna got used to seeing these stones around the city. It wasn't until he went to pharmacy school in Italy that he realized other cities weren't built with pieces of an old Jewish cemetery. When he came back home, he decided to do something.
There was no one else to care for, so I had to care for myself.
There was nobody here to defend the memory of the Jews.
Reina Moho is a historian who studies the Jews of Thessaloniki. She doesn't get involved in recovering tombstones, but she knows the history.
So there was a murder of people, and there was a murder of consciousness and memory. Mnemocide, if one could build a word like that in English.
Thessaloniki used to have a Jewish cemetery in the center of town, a huge one.
It was 350,000 square meters, and it had close to 350,000 graves.
But during World War II, the Jews were forced to give up the cemetery as part of a payment to the Nazi occupiers, and almost all of the Jewish population was later deported to death camps. The local Greek government took the opportunity to knock down the stones and loot them for building materials. Later, a university was built on top of the old graveyard. In 2014, Aristotle University erected a memorial for the Jewish cemetery.
Have you heard about the monument that acknowledges that the university was built on the Jewish cemetery?
No. First time I hear.
No.
But none of the students I ask know anything about it.
So you can see, even there in those walls, headstones standing from the old cemetery.
Jackie Benmayer was at the opening of the memorial at the university. He's a 69-year-old retired businessman who knows Hebrew, Ladino, and Greek. When he spots one of the old stones, he calls the government archaeological service to dig it out with a shovel and pickaxe. And he helps them read the inscriptions and return the stone to the Jewish community.
So it shows that this man was a tailor or something like that.
Benmayer is interpreting an old tombstone. We're at a Jewish cemetery about a 20-minute drive from downtown Thessaloniki. This is where they bring recovered headstones from the old burial ground. He stands in front of small pieces of marble and brick.
You cannot really decipher anything here because they're very small. I mean, how can you decipher anything? But you can't throw them away because they are part of the heritage.
Benmayer has returned headstones here so many times, he doesn't feel emotional about it anymore. There's only one tombstone that stands out to him now. His father's, who was a Holocaust survivor. He died in 2009. His tombstone is fully intact, and there's an inscription on it in Hebrew, Ladino, and Greek, and a phrase from an Italian song.
This sentence here from the song says, don't forget me. Non ti scordar di me, don't forget me. And we don't forget him. Whether we like it or not, we don't forget.
For the world, Rene Gross, Thessaloniki, Greece.
Finally today, Father's Day is coming up this Sunday, and there's a group of men from around the world who are asking dads not to take the day off, but to pitch in. The group includes men from 40 different countries, and they're calling for gender equality. They've just issued a huge report called State of the World's Fathers. Christina Asquith, who heads our Across Women's Lives project, reached out to get a better sense of what this group is trying to do. Christina, what is this group trying to do, and who are they?
They're a really interesting group. It's an international coalition of male-led feminist groups from around the world, led by the U.S. organization called ProMundo. They represent men from the Balkans, from South Africa, from across the Middle East, Brazil, and they're men who really believe in gender equality, but they look at it through a male lens. So they're saying, we need to do more housework, we need to stop violence against women, we need to be more involved in our families' lives because it's better for us.
But are these usual suspect men who are already kind of sensitive and thinking about it and they're, you know, maybe traveled? I mean, what kind of men in these countries is this group reaching?
I don't think so. In the Middle East, we have a group of Palestinian hip-hop artists who put together a rap video to protest honor killings. In Brazil, there's men that are saying that they want to be more involved in their children's lives, so they're attending prenatal visits. And in South Africa, you're seeing men, some of whom have been accused of domestic violence, and in part of the process of avoiding jail time, they're coming together to talk about the kinds of perceptions of masculinity that may have led them to abuse their wives or their children. So it's really a cross-section of different types of men. And also, I should say, a lot of government officials are, especially in the Scandinavian countries, are leading this movement.
I'm not surprised Scandinavia is leading it. They always lead these kind of groovy gender equality things.
Yeah.
So that brings us to the report, and what is their message to dads for Father's Day?
The call out in this report is to say, look, guys, you have to step up. You have to do more housework and get more involved. The research shows that men who are more involved in families and in the house tend to be happier and have more income and less violence and overall lead to kind of a more, satisfied family life.
Thanks a lot, Christina.
Thanks, Carol.
Christina Asquith heads our Across Women's Lives project. We go out today with a taste of that Palestinian hip-hop group working to promote the rights of women. The world's theme music is composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend. قبل ما تفضل ما كانت عايشة نسرد قصتها بالعكس الجريمة للولادة جثتها قفزت من الحفرة لحفة الأرض طلعت العض من جبينها وانبلعت بالفرد صدى صوتها صرخ وهي ردت عليك دموعها تصعد من الخد للعينين من ورا غيمة الدخان في وجوه العيلة أخوها بلا خجل حط الفرد بالجيبة لقى عزب المجراف ودهن عرق عشبينه بهزة راس اكتفى من القبر ومقاييسه جروها السيارة تضرب أقدامها PRI, Public Radio International.